welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we will have fantastic shiur. We will have with us Rabbi Moshe Navon. He's both a Rav, he's a rabbi, he's also a musmach, he's also the head scientist of Mobileye. Mobileye is the Israeli company that was sold for $15 billion to Intel, and they do the software, logarithms, and hardware for the self-driving vehicle. Tesla uses them. They'll be able to cross the country. It's the future. In 5-10 years, he said, there will not be drivers in cars. But this brings about an entire complex new area of halacha, and we will be discussing it with him. We will be speaking to one of the great mechanchim of the world, briefly, Rabbi Yehoshua Eichenstein. He will be speaking about what do we tell our children when they open up a paper or they hear about the machlokes that is going on with, you know, both Satmar and Peleg, attacking Eretz Yisrael, attacking the Gedolei Hadar. Well, how you deal mechanach your children when they see machlokes in like this. We will also speaking a bit to Rabbi Avi Neuberger and Rabbi David Newman, and they are two Talmid Chachamim who will be discussing the risks to your Yerushamayim that are caused by travel. You know, if you're working, you could be in China, in Vegas, in Japan, in Los Angeles. How do you maintain your Yerushamayim out in the workforce? We're on the air, Musa Shabbos, 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA, 570 AM, or on WMCA.com, Monday morning, on Nachum Siegel. You can find all our programs at headlinestorah.com with the Maror Mekaymis for many of our shows. We, by the way, have now starting to put the Maror Mekaymis on the app as well. We get many hits at Headlines Radio Show, the app. You can now download the Maror Mekaymis. You can always listen on our hotline, 732-806-8700. Last month, we hit a new high. We had 40,000 listeners last month on our hotline. You can listen to past programs and leave messages. You can always email any questions to info@headlinesbook.com. You know, we have an app. We have the radio. We're on Nachum Siegel, many different things. We track where our listenership is coming from. So we're going to be doing a lottery this week, and we will choose a lottery. If you can email us at info@headlinesbook.com or leave a message on our hotline, 732-806-8700, and say where you listen. That's all you have to say, where you're listening is from. The winner will get $250 gift certificate to your local farm store. The number two winner will win $125 to your local farm store. I always like to put in a little ad for our book. Today, I got an email from Noah Kunin from Sydney, Australia. He writes like this. He says, I teach at the Masada College, which is an Orthodox school in Sydney, Australia, and we've been working hard to create a curriculum. Your book is amazing, and the students love it. Do you have any way for us to, can you give it to us in a PDF so that we can distribute and teach to our students? And I responded to him. I said, NCSY actually uses the book as well to teach, you know, they teach college kids, and they say, you know, halacha, it sounds so outdated to us. And then you open up these discussions and you see how halacha is incredible, so relevant. We're going to hear today an amazing, how the Chazanish discusses a problem that the scientists at Mobileye are grappling with, and nobody in the world had an answer in the entire secular world of philosophy and ethics until the Chazanish brought this to light, an incredibly brilliant thought. So it's really a fabulous book. I would like to ask everybody here to use it. So I'd like to start off with a vart, which I'm sure I will get criticized for, but, you know, I always have people who agree, disagree. So this will be a comment that many of you may disagree with, but Torah is about debate. So here's a vart. Okay, let me share a vart with you. And this is a vart from the grandfather of this Satmar Rebbe, the Sigit the Rav, the Yitav Lev, you can see all Yehuda Teitelbaum, grandson of the Yisbach Moshe. The Yitav Lev says like this. He says, it says that when Bilam wants to curse Klal Yisrael, he takes him up to the mountain, and he takes him to one where he says, Ephes Katseyu Sira, Vekuloi Le Sira. From this peak, you can only see one portion of Klal Yisrael. You can't see all of Klal Yisrael. kavdei li misham. Can you curse him from this vantage point? So the Yitav Lev says, and we'll see Reb Shneya Katla said a, by his Levaya, they said a similar thought. He said, why from the vantage point we see just one bit of it? What's the advantage? Why can you curse from there? So the Yitav Lev says, he says, because when you look at a people, you'll see many times, you'll see people that are charif, they're too spicy, they're inedible, they have parts of them that are bitter, they're like melach, marim kemelach, the tavlin, or inedible spice. At the same time, it could be a wonderful person. Ein sadik baritz ashiyasa toiv alayecha. So he says, the kayach of Moshe, of the ayin toiv, is to see the entire person. And the kayach of Bilam, of the ayin ra, is to segment out, this is what the Sigurd Rav, the Satmar Rav says, the beginning of the Satmar Chassidus says, is the ability to segment out the part that's mar, or charif, etc. And by Reb Shneya Katla's Levaya, the great Rashiv of Lakewood, his son-in-law, the brilliant erudite Tachem Rav Oren Reich spoke, and he said, Reb Shneya's favorite vart was, he said, he always used to say, Haveidan es kol ha'adam lekavschas. Right, we should judge everybody in a just a positive light. She said, Reb Shneya used to say, why kol ha'adam? It should say kol adam, every man kol ha'adam. So Rav Reich said, he said, zvuv ha'olich l'makam ha'pagam. A fly always finds the fall, the crack, the pus, the wound. And if you focus on that, if you just take a microscope, if you're a dermatologist and you look at a person through a microscope and you see their pimple, you say, this is Mr. Pimple. A healthy person sees the entire person, and they see that on their face they have a little pus and a pimple. So he said, Reb Shneya said, Havidan es kol ha'adam, not every person, but judge the entirety of one person, and then you will always be lekavschos, or more, much more often lekavschos, because everybody has flecks and blemishes and pimples and sores. And why do I say that? I say that in every relationship, I'm sure that to almost every one of our listeners, unless you're really a tzaddik who's married, that your spouse has one time said something that has hurt your feelings or insulted you, or maybe they didn't treat your mother or your father one time, or said the wrong thing about going to your parents' house for Shabbos or for Yom Tov. Brother-in-law, did your spouse once say something about your brother-in-law or your brother or sister? I mean, and you were really upset. So is that a reason for divorce? Or is that a reason to create lack of harmony? You understand, Danis Kala Adam, look at the entire relationship. Look at the entire person. Like the great Satmar Rebbe, the Yitav Lev, said, Efes Katseyu is the language of Bilam. The Ayin Toiv looks at the entire thing. I want to mention it because there was an Asifa 2 weeks ago in Barclays Field, and there was one last week in Lakewood, in Muncie. And it was basically an attack on the Israeli government and on the Medina, quote-unquote, about the language that was used, Doyreshul Shmad, Yereg Val Yaver, Yalde Tehran, the other place, in Teman, Yalde Teman, really ranting and raving about it. So think of, you know, in Torah, you know, emotion is very good, but in Halacha, facts rule, okay? Last year, the Israeli government gave $1 billion to support Kollelim and Yeshivas. So they are the biggest supporters of Torah in history. Because even though the American government gives, but it really doesn't give for Hebrew studies because of separation of church and state, it's meant for the English department, et cetera, but they're not giving it for Hebrew studies. Just as they don't go to Christian schools or Catholic schools for their studies. So the Israeli government is by far, there are 10 Moshe Reichmans, there are 1,000 Rechnitzes, take your favorite Baal Tzedakah, there are many zeros, right? And let's talk about medical care. I know for me, medical care for my family in New York City, Blue Cross Blue Shield, it's around $20,000. Israeli government gives free medical care to all Haredim. It's $1.5 billion they spent last year. And by the way, medical care in Israel, notwithstanding people who come collecting for it, but if you go online, Bloomberg says it's the fourth best medical care in the world. right? Better than, it rates higher than the United States. Longevity is. So do we agree with everything the Israeli government does? Clearly not. Yalde Tehran, which happened around 50 years ago, that's longer than the fight you had with your mother-in-law, right? 50 years ago, Yalde Tehran, or Yalde Tehman happened 60 years ago, right? Was it a terrible thing? Terrible, without a doubt. Stripped children from their parents with the intent of making them irreligious and sent to the army. Many governments ago, almost everybody who did it is dead today. Millions of people, and the government is huge, right? Are there flecks and flaws and blemishes and dents, and are there many people in any government, and certainly in that government, that say things that are objectionable? Is the Israeli Supreme Court have real issues with religion? Absolutely, right? But as a whole, when you go, have you been to Yerushalayim lately? Have you been to Bnei Brak? Has there ever been a place in history where Torah has flourished so much? So to get up and to march and to curse them and to say things that Goyim are afraid to say, right? To equate Zionism with racism, all these terrible placards and curses, and, you know, isn't that, didn't the first Satmar Rebbe say, Efes Kotseyu Sira, the Kuloi Le Sira? If we just look at the blemishes, if we can somehow always find the bad in everything, like, isn't that anti-Torah? Isn't that anti? Didn't Reb Shneur say Danis Kala Demakavchas? We disagree with many things, but to do such marches, and I think I don't see, according to the Satmar Rebbe and Reb Shneur, it's certainly inappropriate. You know, there was a fellow, a story with a fellow. He was on his deathbed, and this was a fellow. He managed to see. He had the koyach to see bad in everything. So his long, long-suffering wife is sitting there. He's in his 80s, on his deathbed. And he says to her, he says, you know, Razel, before I die, I want to tell you something I've always wanted to tell you. So this long-suffering wife from this critical husband looks at him, and her eyes light up. Finally, say it before he dies. What, Yossel? What do you want to say? He says, wait, Razel. Do you remember when we were dating out, we were dating, and I didn't have money for the bus, and you paid the bus fare? Yeah. I wanted to tell you, Razel. What? Wait, not so fast. And after we were married, I was learning, you supported me. You took two jobs. Yeah, Yossel. I want to tell you, Razel. Wait, one more thing. And you remember when I got sick afterwards, you took a fourth job to support the family because I was unemployed for 3 years? Yeah? And you remember after that, Razel, you nursed me to my health? I want to tell you, Razel. Yossel, what? Wait, one more time. And now in this sickness, Razel, have you been at my bed so long? I always wanted to tell you. Yossel, what did you want to tell me? Razel, I wanted to tell me, you bring me such bad luck. So there's an ability to see the bad in everything, and there's the ability to see the positive, the ayin tov, the kayach ha'maisha. I think it's by nature we look for the bad because we always, that, you know, we want to survive. But at the end of the day, we should try to see the good. That's the message of Talmidei Avraham Avinu. So let's hear. I asked the following question to this great Mechanech, Rabbi Yeshua Eichenstein, Rabbi Shiv Yad Aaron. He's a Mekurav, a very Mekurav Trav Steinman. How are we Mechanech our children when we see things like this? We don't want to say bad things about other Yidin, certainly Yidin, or Shomrei Torah mitzvahs. They, in many ways, they're holy, but they have this issue where they march and they say terrible things, and, you know, about the Gedolei Yisrael, about Reb Chaim, who should live till 120, Reb Shaim. What do we say to people? I asked them, how as a mechanech would you address this? Listen to what Rabbi Yeshua Eichenstein had to say. I want to ask a topic that in America has been in the news a lot, and that is that there was just recently an asifa, and many, you know, Rabbanim got together, a few Rosh Hashivas and a lot of Chassidish Rebbes, and they were basically spent a whole asifa, and there was a big asifa in Brooklyn with thousands of Hasidim, and they came and they were screaming that against the Israeli government, and how the draft is the worst thing, it's Gzeiras Hashmad, etc. And on the other hand, there are Rosh Hashivas who, I mean, the Gadol Hador, the Gdaili Hador, say that that's not the case. Just as parents, when our children see this conflict, what do we tell them? Like, how do we explain when they know that, you know, the Gadol HaDor is Reb Aaron Leib, you should live to be 120, and HaGaon Reb Chaim, and yet there are people with who seem to have real, you know, credibility, they have, you know, vice abord, and they look at this. How do we explain this to our children? As a mechanech.
I would prefer not to speak about it. It's a very difficult topic, very lengthy topic. I have a lot to say on the topic. Let me just say something very, very general. There are different drachim in Torah. And in the dor of the dorshel that it says that every dor has the manig that knows how to deal with the problems of that dor. That's b'chol dor of the dorshel. One dor could have a certain handhoge, another could have a different handhoge. Not everybody is able to understand the proper handhoge for our dor. They don't understand that every door is different, and every door has door the door shof. The Kaddish Baruch was mechalik the doiros lefi the different gedolim, and a lot of people don't understand the problems of today's door and the proper andoge. There could be big talmid chachomim, there could be such a derech bechlal, but it's not the derech for this door. Kaddish Baruch Hu sent Rav Steinman, Yarech Yomim Vishonim to our door. He understands the door. He knows how to be manic the door. Not everybody understands it. Other people think they remember different tanhogas and different doors and different things. The same thing was when the Chazinish was, the Chazinish. There were people in Yerushalayim that didn't understand the Chazinish tanhoga. They came to him and they said he's doing the wrong thing and so forth, so forth. This is what's happening today. Not everybody understands the door. Not everyone understands the right tanhoga for the door.
The Reish Kol B'nei Agoyla and Reb Chaim Kinyevsky, they understand this dayer, they are the manhige hadayer, and even though there are other opinions, and they could be opinions from people who are Yirei Shemayim and Talmidei Chachamim, they are not the manhige hadayer. That is how we explain this to our children. Okay, before we introduce Rabbi Navon, I would like to just explain a little bit of the issues. You know, there's a famous ethical problem. I think in the 1960s, a philosopher went around the world asked the following question. He said, imagine you see a trolley car, a train, that's going down the tracks, and somehow five people, it sees 100 feet in front of it, five people sitting there. I don't know how they got there. Maybe they were tied up in Afghamina. And the train cannot stop in time or will kill all five people. At the same time, there is a track on the side which is unused and it wasn't supposed to be used. And you, the third party watching, could press a button, divert a switch, divert that train onto the side and save the five people. However, there's one problem. There's one person sitting on the track over there who you will then kill. Do you save the five people or do you save the one person? Right? Chazanish, by the way, was asked this question, similarly in a case of a missile. A missile is going towards a town. You can kill many brachmanos on many people in a town, divert it and kill one person. So many people say, not all, but many of the people in this audience said that they would divert the train and kill the one person. The lives of one or the lives of many, you would choose the lives of one. We're going to talk about it as Yerushalmi and Trumas, that says Nishtazai. But this is the question. All right. And he then followed up with a question. Well, you said save the lives of the five. Well, what would be the case if you're the bystander watching, you're the one with the switch, but you see that there's no track on the side, but there's a bridge, a walking bridge, that goes over these tracks. And you see the train hurtling at the five people. And up on top of the walking path, you happen to be up there watching, there's a really fat fellow. He's 450 pounds, 500 pounds. This guy eats yapchik three times a day, 360 days a year. He's standing there on top. And you know, with a little push, you could send him hurtling off the path. He would land in front of the train, stop the train cold, and you would save the five people's lives. Would you push this guy off to save the five people or not? Now think about that. Now, what's interesting is many people in the crowd who said they would stop the trolley, stop the train, would and divert it and kill the one, would not push this person off. And nobody could articulate what the difference is until the great Chazanish And it's interesting, the Chazanish discusses this problem decades before this English philosopher brought called the trolley problem to the public's attention. And the Chazanish says an astonishing thought. He says, this that there's a klal in Kol HaTorah that you cannot, you know, if they surround the city, you can't give one out. He says, that's because you're doing a maisa of killing. You're doing an act of cruelty, throwing somebody to the lions. We don't throw somebody to the lions. But he said, if you're doing an act of hatsala, an act, a hero act of saving, such as diverting something, that's not an act of achzarius. That's not an act of killing. You're doing an act of saving. Collateral damage to your saving, incidentally, somebody will die. He said that. He says the Baderach Efsher, he says the Pasuk, would be very likely Mutta. So diverting the trolley, doesn't speak about the trolley, according to the Chazanish, would likely be Mutta. Pushing somebody off a bridge is an act of Achzarius. It's not an act of Hatzalah. It's an act of Achzarius that collateral to it is a Hatzalah. Right? Whereas the other case is letting somebody out of the city is an act of Achzarius, collateral to that is Hatzalah. Which is the dominant, what defines the action? So that is really, and now with these cars, we're going to speak to the engineer who years before accidents happen, he's deciding, how do we turn that vehicle? Who will die? Who will live? We're speaking to somebody who truly almost acts like a god in deciding who will die and who will live in vehicles. He is writing the software for practically every car that will be on this planet in 15 or 20 years. It's starting already now. Teslas are self-driving. Let's go to a fascinating interview with Rabbi Moshe Navon.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone from Efrat, Israel, Rabbi Moshe Navon, who is the design manager for Mobileye. Mobileye is the largest software company in the world that designs and powers autonomous self-driving vehicles, designs the programs. I'm not an expert. I don't know the exact language, but he designs the brain that will allow self-driving vehicles, give them their instructions. Welcome, Rabbi Navon.
Thank you very much. If you'll permit me, I'll just make a slight corrections about what exactly Mobileye does. We're not really a software company. We make algorithms, which are the way that computers think about things, and we put that in software, and then all of that runs on very sophisticated hardware. And so it's really the whole combination of hardware, software, and algorithms that makes Mobileye the company that it is.
And I understand that Mobileye, it was the largest purchase of an Israeli company ever for over $15 billion by Intel, which very much wanted to get into the business of hardware and software for automated vehicles. Is that correct?
Correct. I mean, Intel bought Mobileye for $15.3 billion, which, yes, as you stated, is the largest purchase of any company in Israeli history. And it really says a lot about Israeli innovation, Israeli technology. Intel is the largest chip maker in the world, and they came to buy a chip from us. There's another sort of paradigm shift beside the fact that they paid a lot of money, and that is that they didn't just buy the company and then, you know, change the name to Intel and come and see who's there and swap them out with Intel employees or Intel computers or anything like that. In fact, they bought us to take over them. They have an ADG, or Automotive Development Group, where they've been working on this issue of trying to make cars safe to the point of having autonomous vehicles. And they decided that they would be best suited to have Mobileye not only as a part of that, but Mobileye take over their ADG. Their Autonomous Development their Automotive Development Group is coming under Mobileye. And so it's changing the way people think about Israel, the way people think about Israeli technology and just the innovation that's available here is pretty astounding.
Rabbi Navon, I want to talk to you about the halachic and moral issues, being that you're both a rabbi as well as a software and or hardware engineer, about the ethical and halachic shayla. So let me start the ball rolling and then you take it where you would like to go with it.
Okay,
so,
fine.
You're the programmer of a autonomous vehicle, and you're programming the vehicle. Now, here's a live situation that would happen. The vehicle has five passengers in it. It's on a highway, and suddenly the eye of the vehicle, this electronic eye, detects a truck coming in the opposite direction that loses control and lurches straight towards the vehicle that has the five passengers who are sitting reading the paper because it's driven autonomously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to kill all, the eye can detect it will kill all five passengers in your vehicle. Your vehicle only has one option, to turn into another lane and to kill a motorcyclist who is traveling happily on his way to work, who would otherwise be safe, uninjured. Basically, do you elect to kill the motorcycle driver, or do you say, Sheval Tas Adif, and elect to have your five passengers killed? That is a both ethical and halachic shaila. You as the designer, how do you approach that from a halachic point of view?
Okay, so it's a good question. I mean, you know, these moral dilemmas have been around for a long time. The one that you've just elaborated on is a sort of a twist on the classical trolley problem, where there's somebody looking at a trolley going down the lane, and there's five people on one side and one person on the other, and the trolley's going to hit the five, and the third party can switch the lane to the one. You've made it a little bit more complicated in terms of who's doing what. But nevertheless, it's sort of the same dilemma, and the dilemma is sacrificing the few to save the many. Rav Bleich recently wrote an article in Tradition about it, you know, under different circumstances. There's other variations of it. I mean, there's what they call the tunnel problem, where you have, it would be me in my autonomous vehicle coming down the road and somebody else is in the way, and so do I run him over and save myself, or do I have the car run off the road or into the mountain, whatever it is.
So Rabbi Navon, let's go through them one by one, because
okay. You've
worked on this for a long period of time. Our audience hasn't. Let's go
okay. With
one-on-one. The autonomous vehicle has a choice. There's one person in it.
One
the
person,
a truck
excellent.
Coming towards, yes. Let's start with one and move to many. There's one person in the vehicle. A truck is coming at it. You could direct the vehicle into another lane, kill a motorcyclist or a cyclist, and save your passenger. What do you direct your vehicle to do?
Right, okay. So like you said, I mean, I think that we should maybe start from the beginning, which we started now a little bit more complicated with, you know, many against one, and now we went to one and one. Really, we need to take just one more step back and just ask, you know, how have ethicists in general dealt with this? And there's a distinction between two ways you can approach an ethical problem like the ones that we're discussing. One is they use this really big word called deontological. Deontological, basically, it means there's people who say, I have a principle, like ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh, right? You don't judge between one person and another, or ein horgin b'yadayim, you don't go and kill somebody for whatever reasons it is, you're not allowed to kill somebody. So these are principles. And so we would try to take all of these cases and we'll apply these specific principles to try to come to a decision. Now, there's another group, and that group, they're called the consequentialists or the utilitarians. They basically look at the consequences, at the utility, at the final result. I have a case now of five people versus one person. What's the best outcome to save the five? I don't care if you have to run over the one who was merrily on his way, not involved. I just look at the consequences of the whole picture. And so I don't really have this specific principle of ein horgin b'yodayim, you know, we don't kill somebody actively for no reason outside of the Beit Din or whatever it is. And so these two groups, whether they're, you know, Jewish or not Jewish, religious or not religious, they sort of define all kinds of people how to approach these problems. Now, as a rav, as a person who lives by halacha, so we try to use certain principles. And so, like for the yachid mul yachid, for the individual, where there's we have to make a decision between two people. So, you know, we have this primary principle which Rava states in the Gemara in Pesachim that says, "My chazi d'dama didach sumai tzei." That, you know, how do you see your blood redder? Of course, your blood isn't redder. You cannot judge between one person and another. And therefore, just based on that statement, if I can't judge between two people, I have no right to take the life of the other person. If I'm going on a tunnel, if I'm on a straight road, mountain road, where it's either go off the cliff or drive over the guy that's in front of me, so from this single principle of Rabbi, I would have to kill myself and not kill the other person. It would be a Yareg Val Yavor.
And this everybody would agree to, right? That where it's one-on-one, a person could either go off a cliff or kill an innocent person. That the concept is, my chaz is, why is my blood redder than his? And therefore, the person would have to go, would everybody agree to that? And halacha,
okay, so,
I don't know about the ethicists and the Umay Salem. I'm talking about halachically, would everybody agree with that?
Well, with certain provisos. See, and that's where the, you know, things start to get complicated. I mean, as a as an explicit principle in the Gemara of my chazit, everybody agrees to that principle. But nevertheless, there's all kinds of factors that complicate the final decision. So everybody agrees to the idea that I cannot judge another person. You know, I don't know where they're at. They don't know where I'm at. And so, in a certain sense, we're all equal. But then things start to change. So you have, for example, the Tosfos in Sanhedrin. These, and it's on the same. It's the same statement of Rava that basically, you if somebody said go and kill somebody else, or I'm going to kill you, so you have to give up your life. But if somebody said go, let me throw your body on a little baby, and you will crush the baby, and it will die. So the Tosfos said you're not actively killing. You're not. This is eino harigabi yadaim, and so you are allowed to allow yourself to be thrown on this baby. So basically what he's saying is that you're not allowed to actively kill, but you are allowed to passively kill. And so now you have a different situation. If you're driving on the road and you're just driving straight and presumably, like, let's say that you're in an autonomous vehicle or you're in, you know, even cruise control, so you're not really doing anything. You're just driving straight. So this would be considered passive, according to some at least. And if the road was curved, so now you're actively turning the steering wheel if you're not in an autonomous vehicle, but you actually have to do something to follow the lane, and now the guy is around the turn, so now you're actively killing him, and even Tosfot would say that you're not allowed to run him over, you have to run off the cliff.
But you're saying in a case where if you just went straight, it would kill the other person, in other words, if the road was curving, and if you went straight, you killed the other person, b'shev al tasa. But
if the road was if the road was not curved, it would be considered shev al tasa.
Right.
According to
Tosfos.
Now,
here's the question. So you could, in other words, so you could figure out a case where it's b'shev al tasa, so maybe let the vehicle kill the other person to save yourself, b'shev al tasa. That's what you're suggesting, right, Tais. But my comeback to you would be, is when you're programming the vehicle, so it's constantly being programmed, so it's being programmed to go straight. So the program is not b'shev al tasa, the programmer is b'kum baseh. He's programming the vehicle.
Okay, so now if we get into the programming, it starts to get a little bit more complicated, and it's not exactly like you're putting it, because if I just say, if the program just says go 50 miles an hour and follow the lane markers, it's not actually doing anything new. It's not actually making a new decision. You follow? So there's room to say that it would still be.
But you're making.
Who's making the decision?
The programmer is commanding it when it sees this in this situation, how to react. So this is, b'kum baseh, it's being given instruction 10 years in advance as to how to deal with the situation. So wouldn't that arguably be not shev al tasa, but kum baseh? You're telling it to continue despite it's going to kill somebody because it's straight ahead. So that computer program is being written years in advance. Isn't the program in
right?
Effect?
So, okay, so I think that there's two different ways to look at it. I mean, I think that there is room to say that there would be a piece of code that said drive 50 unless. And so it never gets to that unless, and so it just is driving 50, and so there isn't really a kum asay. On the other hand, you follow, but on the other hand,
yes,
you could look at it the way you're saying it, and saying that when the programmer sits down to write his code, so any decision that's being made is a kum asay, because it's the decision
right
that's being made. And so the decision, even the decision to continue driving, is a kum asay. And so there is room to say that no matter what you do in a program vehicle as opposed to a person driving, we could make a distinction and say a person could get into a case of shev al taseh, but a computer program would never get there and would always be kumase because it's always being written in advance to do something.
Question.
Right.
So let's draw up just for our audience. So on a one-on-one, barring these very lumdish, incredibly thoughtful, you know, iterative things that would change it, but if it's a straight one-on-one, we would say, and you would have to go off the cliff, right? Absent the Tosfos. Now let's go to the next case where it's a little more complex, the trolley case, where there are four or five people in the car, and the truck will wipe out everybody in the car unless it veers off the highway or into the next lane and kills a single individual. How do you, as a rabbi, as well as a software engineer, what's your take on it?
So, I mean, you know, as a rabbi, so we go to the sources, right? There's the Yerushalmi in Trumot that talks about a group of goyim that comes to a city of Jews and says, give us somebody or we kill everybody. Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan have a machloket about it. At the end of the day, the Rambam Paskins like Reish Lakish, which says that unless they said, give us Reuven, and Reuven happens to be Chayav Mita, that he has the death penalty hanging over him. In any case, the whole city has to die. This is like the classic source that says you cannot save the many by sacrificing the few. But nevertheless, there's a famous Chazon Ish on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where he talks pretty much about our trolley case of the few and the many, where he discusses an arrow or a missile going toward a large group of people, and somehow you have the power to sway the arrow or missile to go and hit only one person. And can you save the many by moving this arrow, or in our case, this autonomous vehicle, to the few or to the single individual? And
Rabbi Navon, which in Israel, sadly, is very common. They send a Scud missile at Tel Aviv.
Right.
It could kill many people. And then they shoot a Patriot missile to knock it down. And the guy who's shooting the Patriots is going to fall on a house and kill an innocent person in a house who was never part of this entire argument, was never threatened in the first place.
Halacha,
could he send a Patriot up, or does he have to allow the Scud to land in Tel Aviv? This is the exact case of the Chazon Ish. You see it, unfortunately, very real time in Israel.
Correct. I mean, the only thing is that it's slightly different with shooting the Patriot because, A, they're basically trying to take out the missile completely, and if there is some kind of fallout, it's completely unknown. Here we're actually being very specific and saying, I am going to kill this other person. The Chazon Ish the Chazon Ish has a bit of a difficulty about what should be done. I mean, in terms of the specific case that you're talking about, that it would seem that Rav Asher Weiss talks about it and would allow the Patriot to hit, especially if you didn't know. If you knew that you were going to kill somebody else, then it becomes more complicated. But if you're just like deflecting something to save the many, and then there's some other fallout, I would definitely not call that Hariga B'Yadayim, you know. But here we're talking about Hariga B'Yadayim. Here we're talking about we're going to move the car, we're going to move the missile, and we know it's going to hit Reuven. And so what the Chazon Ish says is that perhaps moving the arrow is different than handing over the Jew in the city that's become surrounded by goyim. He says that moving the arrow is really a pu'ulat hatzala, as opposed to a pu'ulat achzarit, he calls it. So it's instead of it being a, you know, handing over somebody, which is a brutal act, here the moving of the arrow is really in large and in principle an act of saving. Nevertheless, even though he says that he's not sure, because really at the end of the day you are killing somebody, and so everybody agrees that you can't kill somebody with your own hands, as it were. That's the terminology. So the Chazon Ish gives us a little bit something to go on, but he doesn't give us a definitive answer.
So the Yerushalmi in Trumas brings a brisa. It says that basically you're not at Lahalacha. They surround the city. They say, give us one person or we'll kill everybody. You're not allowed to give one person out. And so Shiloh, as they named the person, he's Chayiv Misa, not Chayiv Misa, but that's how the Rambam Paskins.
Correct.
Brings both days. So he says, we don't the halacha believe that you can save an entire city by giving one innocent person out. You cannot save the many by sacrificing the one. So in the case of the car, therefore, you would not be able to save the five passengers to kill the one person. However, you mentioned the Chazenish, which I believe is in Sanhedrin, Semen Chasei, for anybody interested. And the Chazenish says it's chilek. Over there, by giving out a person, you're doing an act of maisa of hariga, b'tzichi, giving, you're throwing him to the lion. Whereas when you're deflecting a missile, you're doing an act of saving, an act of hatzala. Due to the act of hatzala, somebody else, there will be collateral damage and somebody will be killed. But the act that you're doing is an act of hatzala. So are you somech on this? Do you rely on this Chazenish when you design a program? Because I believe the Chazenish is mesupik, and the Chazenish says it's b'derech efsha, and he's uncertain.
Correct. That's absolutely true. And in case you may already be aware, but like the Tzitz Eliezer poskens against and says explicitly that one cannot save the many by sacrificing the few. And he brings, and the Tzitz Eliezer brings the case of the car itself. If you ask about programming, so I think that we should also be clear about a few things from the high tech world. Number one is that we are basically trying to reduce traffic accidents. We are basically trying to make the roads safer. The goal is to make the roads safer. A few years ago, the World Health Organization published the number of 3,300 people are killed or die in car accidents every day. Every day. So we are trying to basically reduce that number to, I would say, you know, zero, or it's not going to be zero, but it's going to be very far from 3,300 a day. Now, another piece of information you have to understand is that we are trying to make the cars drive and integrate as smoothly and seamlessly as possible, and so we're very much concentrating on how to get cars to drive seamlessly together. We believe that the cases that we are talking about, while incredibly interesting and have been around, as we said at the beginning of this conversation, for a long time with names like the tunnel problem, the trolley problem, we believe that these are going to be incredibly, incredibly rare. The more and more that autonomous vehicles are on the road, the farther and farther apart any kind of situations like this are going to arise. Because all these cars are talking to each other. They're completely connected by not just the camera system that Mobileye is expertise at, but there will be LIDAR, radar, vehicle-to-vehicle talking, GPS. There's going to be a whole range of technology that's surrounding each and every individual car. So in reality, we don't believe that this is really going to happen. There are other bigger problems that the cars are going to need to deal with as opposed to the trolley problem. Nevertheless, it is something that needs to be dealt with. And from what I've understood from the people that are working directly on these algorithms is that these kinds of things, these safety issues are going to be defined by governments. They're going to be defined by regulators who are going to say, in our country, the way that a car should react to the trolley problem is X. You know, we believe in utilitarianism. We believe in deontology. We believe in this rule or that rule. And Mobileye or any other car manufacturer that's designing the code for this is going to be beholden to those people who are really responsible for setting the law down. So as an engineer, as programmers within a company that's working on these things, we are working to make cars as safe as possible, to make the roads as safe as possible, but we are not actually coding a trolley problem at this day.
But let's say that the government tells you to code it. So whoever's
right,
doing it, whichever Jewish person in Israel is doing it, could be a rotseach, according to, you know, the Chazedish is b'sof. According to the other side of the Chazedish, this person could go to sleep at night and say, well, the Chazedish said it's a suffix, it's 50-50, maybe today I killed a person. How would you respond to that if I ask you?
So I would say,
I mean,
it's
good that you're making the world a better place, but still, we have to go with halacha. How would you respond?
Absolutely, I agree 100%. I agree 100%.
Put on your rabbi cap.
Yes, absolutely. I wear my rabbi cap every day, 24/7. I believe in halacha. I believe in living by halacha, and I think that the question that you're asking now is could really be asked for any profession where the boss asks you to do something against halacha. it's going to be a very difficult position for the individual that he may have to get up and walk, right? I mean, if you really are being put in a position that you believe you are going to violate halacha, I mean, you can't steal, you can't kill, you can't, you know, I mean, those are the extreme examples, of course, but there are, people face these kind of questions every day, and hopefully not so much, but you know, there are times when somebody has to put their priorities and take a difficult decision in Parnassa. At this point, we haven't been put in that position. I would say that I think that there will be a consensus, and as we're seeing through the sources, you know, we didn't get to touch on all of them, but there are positions going in many different directions, and I would like to share with you a couple of things that are being discussed. On this specific issue, making a distinction between the programmer autonomous vehicle versus the driver himself. So, for example, there's a kola under Rav Asher Weiss, which is called the Machon HaTorani LeHeker HaAtid, which is basically the Torah Institute for the research of future issues. And they came up with a very novel way of looking at this problem. They said like this, okay, if a driver is driving down the street and the classic trolley problem, I'm driving down the street, my lane has five people and there's a guy and there's a lane next to me with one person, I'm going to have to choose one of them to drive over. So we said that I have to shev al ta'aseh, I cannot kum aseh, I cannot kill somebody by a dime. Switching my lane would be killing them by my own very straight will, and so I just have to try to apply my brakes as much as possible, but basically I can't go out and kill somebody else. I mean, that's explicit in the Tzitz Eliezer and others as well. Now, what about the car being programmed? Does the car being programmed have any leeway? So these guys from Rav Asher Weiss's Kolel, so they said, look, the programmer is in a completely different situation because when he is sitting making the decisions that he's programming, he's actually working under the modus operandi of saving the world. He's trying to save as many people as possible. He's trying to raise the statistics of every individual on the planet Earth being saved. And so now his decision making at that point is to try to save as many people as possible, and so he is not beholden to that explicit case where there are five people in front of him or one person in front of him and he has to either sheva tes or kum tase. He is basically at this, like we said at the beginning, at a kum tase position, and so it's a choice of either killing five or killing one, or really the way they look at it is saving as many people as possible. And since there isn't really anybody in any lane, the programmer is taking into account everybody in the world and raising the statistics that they will live. So that's their approach, and
actually,
they say, yeah, go ahead,
Rabbi Navon. I don't understand that answer.
Chazenish,
on the side of the Chazenish, that you're not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to deflect the missile.
Correct.
I mean, it would be one missile, 100 missiles, or 1,000 missiles, but the Chazanish changed his mind on the opinion of the Chazanish. So this guy is writing right now in the code, he's saying, in the case where there's five people in the car, and there's one person going to get killed, because of the other side of the Chazanish, it's a suffix of Ritzicha, and therefore we're going to say you can't do it. Well, if it's five cars, 1,000 cars, 1,000,000 cars, I don't think the Chazanish would change his mind. The same halacha, it's just done repetitively. I don't understand the thought.
Okay, so I think that your question is in place, but nevertheless, what they would answer you is what they've answered me is that the Chazon Ish uses this term pulat hatzala versus pula achzarit, and this pula achzarit is where you're looking at somebody and you see here there's this guy and I'm going to run him over. That's brutal. Okay, but when you're sitting writing code, there is no brutality. You're not actually running over anybody. You are actually trying to save as many people as possible. And so they look at that situation as a pool of writing the code as a pulat hatzalah.
Even though they're specifically writing it for the case of the Chazanish where you're deflecting the missile and you still not allowed. Other side of the Chazanish is even a Pulas Hatzalah is not allowed where it's killing somebody. That's what the quandary of the Chazanish. So his other thought is, no, even though it's a Pulas Hatzalah, you're still not allowed to do it. Which seems
correct.
To be directly opposite Rabbi Weiss's conclusion.
Yes, it's true. Everything you're saying is true. But for now, like I said, I mean, these people are still working on this idea. So I would, they call the paper that they put out, they call it a draft. It's a tuta. So they're working on this idea, and I would say that it needs more work. But I'm throwing it out there as something that's being thought about, you know, in a very serious way by very serious thinkers here in Jerusalem. I wanted to give you another idea, and that's also something that we sort of mentioned in passing at the beginning, and it's by a friend of mine who's also working on the code, a different part of the code at Mobileye, and he also has smicha, and he's thought about this problem, and he wants to say that while he agrees with the Chazon Ish, he agrees with the Tzitz Eliezer, but programming the car is something different, and the reason that he says it is what I had mentioned before, is that when you are writing the code, you are going to kill somebody. You're going to kill five or you're going to kill one. He says when you're writing code, there is no Shev Al Taseh. There's no Shev Al Taseh. There's only Kumaseh. So if there's a Kumaseh, everybody would agree that it's better to kill one than to kill five. And so he wants to say, there's a friend of mine named Rav Chaim Shachor, and he also, I don't think that, you know, he's also, these are all ideas that are just in thought, they need to be worked out, they need to be found support for, but, you know, this is sort of like a cutting-edge discussion, and so we're just throwing out ideas here. So no one should be held responsible for saying something. But in any case, it is an interesting way to look at the problem, that all programming is kum aseh. It's all, I'm going to either kill this group, or I'm going to kill that group. There is no Shev Al Taseh opportunity, which did appear in the discussions of the Chazon Ish or the Tzitz Eliezer.
Let me suggest something to you, Rabbi Navon, and tell me if you whether this is, it's something you said before. You said you're writing under the auspices of the government. The government is going to tell you what to do, right?
Correct.
So let me throw an idea at you. There's a Gemara in Shavuos. The Gemara says that a king is allowed to enter into a Mulchemes Rishus, that way Tyson learns the Gemara, even though many people will die, up to a fifth or a sixth of the population.
Six, yeah.
I think the Gemara is, yeah, like that's Lamed Hay, I think, right?
Correct.
Something like that.
And
why is that? Because a king has a right, I think the Machreinim say, the Mertzchias and others stay on the spot, because in the Dina, the Malchus Hadina, Shmuel Ashitase, Shmuel's the one that says a king is allowed to, you know, caused the death of many of his people for the Parnassa. Well, it's like the Gemara and Brachas says, they asked David, what should we do? We have no money. He said, go to war. He said, a king is allowed for the well-being of a nation, sacrifice people's lives. So if
right.
you're going to be, and nobody argues on that Gemara, the Meretzchia says over there that it's Dina the Malchus Adina, and nobody argues that in America there's Dina the Malchus Adina, or Moshe writes about it, many Paiskim. I mean, you have real outliers who say there's no Dina the Malchus Adina. Certainly in Chutzlar,
right.
it says Dina the Malchus Adina to that. How does Shmuel say, because of Dina the Malchus Adina, the king is allowed to kill a sixth of the people? He's basically he's causing people to die, and it's permitted, L'tzair of Parnassa, because that is the part of a kingdom's work. That is part of, you know, the business of America is business. The business of any king is to feed their people. And
no,
that
absolutely.
Is why he's allowed to... So,
right,
so
no, I mean, you can use Rashi. I mean, Rashi says to go that he's putting them to work, so fine.
Right, fine.
But he's not making... Right, he's not asking anybody to do anything illegal. He's not asking them to go against halacha.
They're being over shmartim as nafshei sechem. Of course they are. There's an issue to put yourself at risk. The person's not allowed to. You would have a din of a ma'abid at smol adas without this. So Dina the Malchus Adina said it's not ma'abid at smol adas because it's part of the workings of a kingdom. So if he's allowed to put people at risk and not make them ma'abid at smol adas, I would certainly take the position that where he's looking out for their welfare and not ma'abid at smol adas. So I'm not sure I agree with Rabbi Weiss on this either.
There's a group of rabbis that are thinking about it. It's not Rabbi Weiss himself that is arguing these points. Ultimately, I think the only rock-solid conclusion that you can come out of this, besides that Tzarich Iyun Gadol, is that somebody can self-sacrifice. right? Whether it's the case of a one person, you know, like two people malachim b'amidbar, right? With kiton achad b'nehem, the person could give up his life if he wanted to. The same thing with in the city, a person could volunteer and say, "I'm going to save the city." The Gemara brings the example of Lulianus and Papus, and so there is a possibility for self-sacrifice. And so I would offer that there could be an altruistic switch in your car that says, you know, I'm willing to self-sacrifice, right? That, I think everybody would agree to halachically is cogent. But otherwise, this whole story of one against one or passive or active or one against many, passive or active, programmed or driven, all of these things are shanui b'machloket gdola, and like I said, there are serious thinkers that are working on it.
So let me ask you one closing question.
Sure.
Okay. Given that the halacha on this is still, like you say, it's being worked on, right?
Yeah.
And a programmer would be asked, listen, halachically, the Chazon Ish says one to save many, he's not certain. We have other svaras, maybe Dina the Mahusadina. We're not sure, they haven't worked out. Now, do you tell them, does that programmer say, listen, I'm just doing my job and I'm going to write it? Or does he say, wait, could be because of my writing this, there's 3,000 deaths a day. Maybe one of them is because a truck hits a car. Maybe every night I go to sleep and I'm a murderer, according to the other side of the Chazon Ish. What does that poor, innocent programmer do?
Right. So I would say like this. First of all, I gave you the 3,300 number. That's people killing people every day. I have no question in my mind that programmed cars will come nowhere near that. They will maybe kill one or two a year at most, and that may even be an exaggeration. I think that the programmer is, by and large, doing a great service to humanity. So now, okay, you still want to say fine, but, you know, he may end up killing somebody. From our whole discussion, I hope it's been clear that there is enough to go on that places the programmer in a much more cushioned position vis-a-vis halacha than somebody that's driving on the street. And so I think that, you know, at this stage when there is no, you know, clear halacha, and there are a lot of sides to it, and the Chazon Ish himself is sort of like mitlabet, you know, which way is it really? And there are poskim today that have poskim like the Chazon Ish to say, yes, you can sacrifice the few to save the many. I mean, there's Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein wrote in Asiya, and Rav Shlomo Dichovsky. There are people who have sided with the Chazon Ish's reasoning of Pu'ulat Hatzalah.
Wow, that's fantastic. This is really a treat. Everybody, Yashikayat Rav Moshe Navon, he's the head of ASIC Design. He's ASIC Design Manager for Mobileye, the largest software/hardware power. I'm sorry, I'm totally untechnical. A designer of the software of autonomous vehicles in the world. Thank you very much, Rabbi Navon.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We have on the great honor of having with us on the phone Harav HaGaon, Reb David Yosef. He's the son of the greatest Paisik of, I don't know, the last many, many years. His father, the Rishon Lezion, Reb Avadya Yosef. He's the Rosh Koil of the Yechaved As Koil. He's the Rav HaRashi in Har Nof. And he's the Chevr of the Mayetzes Chachmei HaTayre. It's such an honor to have you with us, Reb Yosef.
Thank you.
Reb Yosef, can I ask you a question that I get a lot of calls and emails about this on a different topic, but I can't think of somebody who was mishamish by bigger gedolim than you. A lot of yeshiva people go to work, and when we go to the workplace, we struggle very much keeping ruchnius in a very mokum chayil.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about, you know, yeshiva is the most beautiful thing, right? But when we leave yeshiva and we go into the world, how, give a Ben Taira some advice, how do we maintain our sense of Kedusha, our sense of, you know, Kedoshim Tiyu, Yachol Kamayni, the tremendous milus that Kali is, when we have to deal with women all day, when we have to travel to remote corners of the world. Give us a little hashkafa from it's such an honor to have somebody. Your father was maybe one of the greatest Jews who ever lived. Give us some advice to B'nai Torah, to Erlicher people. What do you do when you're a whole day in New York today is Sedoim V'Amoira, the street? How do we both live in that world and yet maintain our Kedusha?
Mm-hmm. Okay. First of all, everyone, every Jewish man, our Hashkofe is that Hashem created the world for Torah. Hashem didn't create the world for Parnasa, for eating, for sleeping, for Gashmias. Hashem created the world for Torah. We have to say to ourselves every day, every morning, from the moment we are awake until night, we have to know we came to this world to fulfill the wishes of Hashem, what He wants from us, and we have to fulfill what Hashem wants. It means to study Torah first. But we know that not everybody can study Torah all the day, and some people should go to work, So Ben Teire that want to work, he asked his rabbis, and they told him, go to work. First of all, he has to think, I need time every day for studying Torah. The best thing is to start the day with Torah. I know in Brooklyn, New York, I go very often there. I see 6 o'clock in the morning. Every synagogue is full in Flatbush, the Syrian synagogues. Every synagogue is full, hundreds of young people coming, even it's snow outside, cold. They don't care. They come 6 o'clock until 7 o'clock they study. 7 o'clock they pray, and some go to work. After, some learn another 1 hour. When I go to that synagogues in the evening, 8 o'clock until 10 o'clock, it's full of young people that working, but in the evening they come, they study. Many offices, I go 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, they have break, short time, to eat lunch. They bring small lunch, and they ask me to come to give them a shiur. I go, I give a shiur. This is a way to walk and still to remain Ben Teire. It means to walk, but every minute I have, if I can make shiur, I can learn Daf Yomi, I can learn here or there, and nobody can say I have no time. Nobody can say that. In the morning, in the evening, everyone can find the time. If he thinks I want to remain Ben Teire, I want to be Ben Teire, I want to make what Hashem wants for me to do in this world, so I have no choice. I have to go for Parnose. I have to study. This is the most important thing. This is first. Second, everyone that's going to work, he has to think what kind of work. Unfortunately, in our generation, the world opened. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening. It's beautiful.
Yes. The world opened, and some people, they have to work. Not only men with women. Some women go to work. They have to work with men. So we have everyone. It's individual. Everyone has to make something gader to prevent himself from avonot. From avonot, he can start from looking to make Chas V'Shalom worse and worse avonot. So, an example, if a man comes to me and he will ask me, I have to be a doctor. I want to be a doctor. And a doctor, I should touch women, I should do something with women. It is allowed? Yes, of course it is allowed. But for myself, I will tell him, I will not choose such a job. So the same thing everyone has to protect himself, to make fence to himself, to prevent himself from making avonot. So it became tougher and tougher every time. Now in our generation, it's not easy. So everyone has to go to his rabbi and to do something, to think what he is doing to remain with Kedusha and to have Parnassah from one side and from the other side to remain Ben Teira.
We have with us on the phone from Muncie, New York, Rabbi Avi Neuberger, who's the Rav of Shari Tefillah. He's also one of the writers for the Art Scroll on the Yerushalmi Project. We additionally have on the phone with us Rabbi David Newman, who's a Rebbe in Shari Torah. He's a founder of the Haravna programs for both Yeshiva Boys and Balabatim. Welcome, Rabbi Neuberger and Rabbi Newman.
Hello, Rav David. How are you?
Shalom Aleichem.
Shalom Aleichem. So I wanted to ask you, guys go out to work, and they're, for the most part, living in a, well, I shouldn't say full, but certainly many live in a sheltered environment within the, you know, the Dalid, Amish al Halacha, the Kaislis HaYeshiva, or if they're coming from a more modern background, they're coming from their group of friends, which sort of restrains behavior and keeps a certain modicum on our actions, etc. And then they go to work, and they have to travel, they have to go to workplace, and there are no restrictions, or no at least visible limitations. So talk to me as experienced mechanchem, what happens to guys in that situation, and what should they be fearful of, and then eventually we'll talk about what can be done to ameliorate or rectify the nisyonos that we have. What are the nisyonos, what happens, and how do we rectify it? Rabbi Neuberger, why don't you start?
So, honestly, when I wrote this article for the Mishpacha magazine, which triggers this conversation, my intention was merely to bring light to the problem. It's something that, you know, was sitting there. It was like an elephant in a room, but nobody ever wanted to talk about it because what are you going to say? And I just wanted to open the conversation. And I spoke about it, and basically just to highlight the same type of things you're talking about. During a regular working day, you have structure, you have a family life, you're coming home, you have a wife, you have children, you have a seder, you're davening with minyanim, hopefully. So there's some sort of structure. You go on a business trip, and nobody knows you. And it's a hefkevelt. I mean, after writing the article, I looked online, and, I mean, this is just to take it to an extreme, that the highest degree of infidelity happens when people are on business trips because nobody knows them. You can feel reckless a little bit. You're lonely. So I'm not in the article.
It's the Gemara in Kiddushin, right? Yelach Labakim Shein Makirin, I say.
That's right. That's right. Exactly right. So now, in a family magazine like the Mishpacha, I wasn't going to get into too many details about stories that I heard personally. But over there, I just described, let's say, the average day of somebody who's like an Erlich guy who's not going to get caught in a major nisayon like that. So good. So he finishes his business day at, what, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, maybe 7? And adults don't go to sleep usually until 11 or 12 o'clock at night. So you have at least 4, 5, 6 hours to kill, to fill. And so how are you going to fill that in a productive way? So in the best case scenario, you just sit in front of a television and veg out and watch things that are inappropriate and even worse than that. But that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that, you know what, we're on the radio, so you'll figure it out yourself. And after writing the article, you know, somebody called me up. I mean, several people called me up. A rabbi called me up that a Talmud of his came over to him to say to him, when you go to China, there are incentives that the business should go to one village, not to another village, and the incentives are sent to the room, you know. So they have all these horrible initiatives, which I didn't myself was not cognizant of, but I just knew that it's something that has to be addressed openly, and people have to talk about it and realize it's a problem. In my article, basically what I did was I was trying to describe a way of doing it, of filling your day in a productive manner, waking up early, doing exercise, you know, and so on. And so to shorten the end of the day, maybe to go to a meeting even though it's far away, just little eitzelach to figure out the problem.
Rabbi Newman, do you have experience with Balabatim too in this capacity, travel, et cetera?
Not really, not with Balabatim, but I do see the nisyonos that Balchem have, which are similar, not exact, but similar. But Rabbi Neuberger is definitely firsthand of to see the issues that Balabatim face in travel, and this needs tremendous addressing on behalf of the Mechanchem.
So Rabbanim, what would you say? A guy is traveling to China. It's it's I don't know, it's a 12, 13, 14-hour different time zone. Total disconnect. He's in some faraway place. What shmiris should a person do?
So if I could respond, and this is really the juice of the program that we developed, Kinyan HaMasechta. The idea of the program is to own a Masechta, to make it your best friend. You know, we say, the Gemara says it's not my Russia, it's Tikri Moirasa. We're married to the Torah. And I just heard recently about this father that brings a small son to a wedding, and he goes into a chasen, and the son tells the father, you know, I see you at college, you're dressed in white, but who's the chasen? Everyone looks the same. And the father tells the son, you know, you're right, it's hard to differentiate who the chasen is right now, but wait till the end of the wedding, and you'll see the person that takes the collar home, he's the chasen. Now, the same thing applies, obviously, to Torah. We're married to Torah. And the person that's learned a little bit in shul and is yaitz design a little bit of a shir in a passive manner, that's not the chasen. The one that takes the Torah home, he's the chasen of the Torah. And that's for businessmen, for rabbeim, for kohel younger life, for bochum, for everyone. We need, the Torah can't just stay in the Beis Medrash. The Torah, the Gemara, needs to come with us at home, needs to come with us on a trip, needs to come with us on a business trip, wherever we are, the Gemara, the Mishnayos, but here we're focusing on Masechtas and Gemara, needs to come along with us. We have Balabatim in the cars with the Gemara, on the planes with the Gemara, and of course in the hotels with the Gemara, because there's a schedule, there's Gemara that need to be reviewed, and I can't begin to tell you how many Balabatim are going, wherever they go, they have the Gemara with them.
I'll tell you, Rabbi Newman, you know, the Gemara in Shabbos, I think it's on Kuf Yud Tes or Kuf Chaf. I think it's Kuf Chaf on Aleph. The Gemara says, L'charva Yerushalayim, when was Yerushalayim? Achabatlu mimenu anshe yamana. People, trustworthy, valuable people. So the Gemara asks the question, the Gemara says, B'va'ika, it says that at the time of the Churban, there were Talmidei Chachamim in Yerushalayim. So the Gemara says, no, B'rchayva is Yerushalayim. That there were Anshe Emana, trustworthy people, who were in the Rechayv of Yerushalayim, they were missing. In other words, the concept of learning they had, but taking the learning home with you to the Rechayv, to the street, to your travels, that's what, that level of integrity was missing when Yerushalayim was Nechrav.
Beautiful, beautiful.
You know, when Rav David called me after I wrote this article, and he said, shouldn't the obvious Eitzah be Torah Tavlin? You know, we all know it, Barasi, Yetzer Barasi Torah Tavlin. So I was thinking to myself, and why did I miss that obvious Eitzah? Because it's not just, you know, learning. It's not like a certain magic of learning by itself that does the trick. Rav Meir Stern writes, and I've heard Rav Albert says the same idea, that it's when somebody has a geschmack in learning, then, you know, it becomes like something he looks forward to. He satisfies his desire for pleasure sort of by having a geschmack of learning. I saw the Maharal says that the reason why men have the mitzvah of Talmud Torah as opposed to women is because men are b'nei kibush, and they vent, or they focus that kibush, that desire of conquest, on, with the Gemara. And when it's not satisfied, we can imagine what happens. So that you have to have a geschmack of learning, and really to have the Torah Tavlin, the Megin Amasli, the protection of learning to work. So when somebody is good in learning, you know, like hopefully all the three of us are on the phone now, so we have a geschmack because we enjoy it. But when you have somebody who's not as proficient in learning, so how is he supposed to get a geschmack? You know, it's like a failure in the whole system almost. It's good for people who are smart, but when people are not smart, how are they supposed to develop a geschmack? And the beauty of Reb David's system that was first instituted for high school and now he's bringing to base for Balabatim as well is that somehow there's a certain magic that when you keep on chazuring and chazuring and chazuring, it gets into your bones and the clarity is very, very satisfying. And it develops a geschmack of learning, and you can have a Balabas who's not just sitting passively by shir, but actively involved in being kind of Masechta. It has a certain magic to it.
And to explain that magic that the Rabbi is referring to, you know, it becomes your best friend. Who doesn't want to travel with their best friend? Who doesn't want the company of their best friend? And it's just amazing. I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, we had literally a whole group, maybe 10 Balabatim went to Florida for midwinter vacation with their kids. but they all brought along the big gemaras from this year, which is all written in, and it's all part of them. They all brought along, and they met every morning in a certain hotel in Miami in a lobby, and they sat there for 1 hour chazering before the day began. You know, this is unheard of a year ago. Why? Because the gemara wasn't their best friend. And the reason why the gemara is their best friend is because they're writing and they're chazering, and they're loving it.
You know, I heard a story of an Adam Gadol who was in Boston, and one of his mekuravim came to visit him, and he said to him, "Are you lonely here all by yourself?" And he said, "Lonely? I take out my gemara, I learn a shtickle gemara, Amar Rav Chisda." He says, "And I don't agree, I don't understand what Rav Chisda is saying." Suddenly my good friend, Rashi, says, "What do you mean? This is what he's saying." And then on the left side, he says, Taisha says, "This is what he's saying. No, that's not what he's saying. This is what he's saying." And they're arguing back and forth. I have my opinion. Then I look in the back, and I see what great Rabbeinu Usher, what's his opinion. And then I go to Rabbeinu Nissen, the Ran, and his opinion. Everybody's arguing. I take out a Shulchan Aruch. I see the Beis Yosef and the Ramah, the Magen Avraham. He says, "I'm surrounded by friends. I don't know what you're talking about when you say that I'm lonely here by myself."
Beautiful.
In Boston.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And I could just elaborate one thing you said before, Reb David, regarding Chayvus Yerushalayim. You know, the pasuk says, "B'chut Chayvay Teleichu," and Rashi says, "Shetiyam Meidam Batayra." We just Rashi see that, and the Rashi sees that from the word Teleichu. When a person in his halicha is learning, that's the right, he's Amal Batayra. And like Rabbi's saying, he's enjoying it, he's living it, he has a geschmack for it.
Thank you, Rabbi Neuberger and Rabbi Newman, the founder of Haravna and Kenyan HaMasechtis for Balabatim. We have with us on the phone from Givat Zev in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Yehuda Spitz. He's the Rosh Chabura of the Orla Gerla Halacha Koil in Yeshivas Har Sameach. He's also the author of the column Insights into Halacha. Welcome, Rav Spitz.
Shalom aleichem.
Rav Spitz, I understand that you've written extensively about stem cell meat. So let me start it with a question. Somebody took a stem cell from a kosher, you know, beef, let's take an easy one, a kosher meat, and they grew it in a big vat of water, and they've given it all kinds of synthetic and other types of chemicals, and now it's a huge piece of meat, but it's grown from nothing. It's grown in a lab. It was never part of a mother animal. Can you take this meat and make a cheeseburger out of it? What is the status of stem cell meat? Is it considered fleishig?
Well, that is actually a very complicated question, and there's many different studies on that. The basic answer, I would say, is that potentially that would be very problematic for many different reasons. I mean, there's many different svaras. I mean, I remember seeing in your book you even wrote about this. I think you concluded that way as well. But it seems to be that the more compelling arguments say that poshtus, a kosher cheeseburger from fake meat or synthetic meat or lab-grown meat, would certainly be highly problematic, especially at this time. And also, the process that you mentioned is not actually the process. I mean, if I would take in and grow it in water, is not the actual metzias, as they the laboratories have their secrets, but certain things have been revealed, and the process itself seems to be more problematic than just if you would grow it in water. There definitely is a strong reason to suspect that such a case might have this din of actual busar. If you took it from a real kosher animal, then, you know, pashtis, the chayr would be kosher. And there would be a very strong, compelling reason to assume that it would even be considered fleishik.
Can you walk our audience through what is the halacha debate? What is the debate? Why would it be fleishik and why would it be parv? Give us a flavor for it. We're a halacha show, so give us a little bit of a debate.
Well, it's not just a little bit of a debate on this one. This would be a lot of debate. Well, the Shiloh first started a couple of years ago. There was a certain professor named Mark Post, if I'm not mistaken, in a university in the Netherlands. And he said he made this first lab-grown burger, and they said it cost $325,000 at the time to make one. He was touting it as, you know, a cruelty-free, quote-unquote, way of growing meat. a nice way of saying, like, a meatless meat, so animals don't have to chas v'shalom, they'll suffer in their terms. But it turns out, it seems to be, you know, halakhically it's not so pashut. So people right away, as soon as that he made his announcement, a couple years back, you know, many newspapers, especially non-religious newspapers, you know, Jewish ones said, oh, wow, we can have a kosher cheeseburger, because if it's man-grown meat, it's not fleishik. So let's have a cheeseburger, no big deal.
Which is, by the way, Rabbi Menachem Ganak of the OU, you know, the OU right now, that's their position, by the way. Not Negei Labai, but they believe
really?
It would be power. Yes, yeah. They believe it would be power. He says it has a din of Yotze. Yotze is power of the Pashtas. Like, right?
But Yotze without Rav Chaim. Rav Yotze made him in a buster.
Well, no, Rav Chaim's, okay. Go ahead, I don't want to
We're jumping ahead of ourselves, aren't we?
Yeah. Okay,
if I remember, I've seen different things from the OU over the years. I don't know what the latest, what they would say one way or the other is. I do know when they first made this announcement, one of the non-religious newspapers said they interviewed a few kosher groups, and some said Mamish Aser, they said Aver Menachai. Now, that seems a bit extreme because Pashas, according to Halacha, in order to be an Aver, has to have a shear, a minimum shear, has to have some sort of metzias that you're taking from, a microscopic stem cell. Doesn't seem to fit the quality in the shear of an aver. I mean, the mice for Marcus is a kazayas, but even without that, it has to have it can be considered an aver. But I mean, on the other side, you have people who are saying, you know, straight up, oh, it's part of, there's no problem, and some compared it to the Gemara in Sanhedrin about Sefer and Sefer Yetzira, and they quoted a Malbim about the Mikvi Parav and Avram Avinu, which says a Basar Shir Osa Avram. You know, that interesting sheet on a Cheshek Shloimeh on that. He says it could even be the milk. Yeah, but, you know, that's theoretics. Is this considered like Sefer Yetzirah? I don't know, because it's actually, it's not Yesh Me'ayin, it's Yesh Me'yesh. Just a microscopic Yesh. And the question is, how do we monitor that? Even on that case
it
of Sefer Yetzirah, you know,
respectfully, it seems almost a foolish comparison to compare it to Sefer Yetzirah. Somebody taking something that's here and growing it through a scientific method, that's not Sefer Yetzirah, where it's, or you know, Chita Habam and Hashemayim. I mean, there's nothing miracle about it. It's science, right?
I fully agree with you.
Honestly, a pretty, really, really nourish a comparison.
Yeah, I think
that
these Rabbanim just sort of just threw out answers just because they were probably put on the spot.
Okay.
But Lamaisa, even if you would take such a comparison, the Pilsay Tshuva passes with the Shua will still be Chayav the Shchita because of our science. But that's a side point. The next thing they said was maybe it's like gelatin. Oh! Now, there's a controversy if that, you know, you ever heard one. So the people who are matir gelatins made from non-kosher animals will say, oh, the same thing here. But those are few and far between. I mean, the OU themselves in America, especially ever since the 1950s and 60s, from the rulings of Rabbi Aaron, Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Eliezer Silver, Rabbi Henkin, you know, unequivocally, Rabbi Silver was fire against it. He said that people misled Rabbi Chaim Eliezer, because they weren't making out of just hard bones, like they said, like his original tshuva, they're making out of skins. It'll be a very strange comparison. And not only that, even if we would say it's like gelatin, gelatin is saying they're relying upon him chadashah. It's based on the Rabbeinu Yoina, you know, the Rosh and Brachas, the Ron and Vodah Zara about honey. But that's panim chadashah's balakan. So I'm changing something. But here you're not changing it. You're taking the actual etzem stem cells and meats, and you're splitting it and growing it and growing it, making it vitre, making a big stem. The same thing growing over again. Where's the chemical change? You're taking something and being modulate. Where does that turn into, I'm changing it through the chemical process? If anything, you're using it to enhance it.
Right,
so,
and I would add on,
again,
I would add on to what you're saying, Rabbi Spitz, is that by gelatin, part of Reb Chaim Moshe's heter is that there is a point where it loses its edibility, and it's just some type of a chemical, and then it converts into gelatin.
Certainly.
This could be, from its microscopic stage, all the way to when it's a burger, it remains edible throughout the entire process.
Very possibly. I fully agree. So again, you know, gelatin would be a very strange comparison to say, matter gelatin, matter this. Again, someone who be ma'ayin in the topic, go through all the makairis and see what the svaras behind it are, wouldn't really conclude that would be similar to gelatin. And even if you would, I don't know how they'd come up with that. Lamaisa, there's no badats, no mahadran agency, no mainstream cautious agency in America, or even that would say such a thing would be kosher anyway. So if I take a trace animal, and I would do that, you know, and I grow from a stem cell, where would we get that from? So pashas gelatin also would be a very schwer comparison. At least that's the way it would seem.
So what about yotze? A lot of paiskim nemon that yotze is parv, and I believe that's what Rabbi Ganax, what he based his hether, and he said this has a din of yotze. It's not the thing itself. It's a derivative of the first animal, and therefore he believed it was parv. What's your opinion on that?
I can't speak for Rabbi Ganax. I haven't spoken with him. But pashtus, even if you go with yotze from Mishnah Bechayrus, the klaus are yotze min atame tame, yotze min atahar tahar, right? Rav Chaim, right? Everyone says yotze is talking about, they think it's about a secretion. They think it's milk, it's brine. I mean, one of the cases, Gemara is actually made a glaim of a chamur. But I'm saying is you're talking like a liquid. That's what they're thinking about. But that's not the case in the Mishnah. The actual case in the Mishnah was a kosher animal. It says that was born somehow from a non-kosher animal, that the meat is still usher. So they'll quote the Rambam on yotze, and they'll say, well, a yotze is these kind of meat that's only a stam yotze. It's not an actual busser, should stay parv. I assume that is what you're referring to from Rabbi Ganax.
Yes, I think he's basing it on it's a Rambam, which actually brought in Chidushi HaGriz in Nazir and Daf Nun, and that's basically what Rabbi Ganax is naming on.
But the problem with that is that the Griz's father, Reb Chaim, and Hilf Machal Sosur's Per Gimel, right, and Yud Aleph over there, he says that even according to the Rambam, there's a difference of Yotze that's actual Basar, or Yotze that's not actual Basar. The Rambam's only talking about eggs, milk, skin, bones, hoofs, horns. But in the case of the Mishnah, it's actually meat. He says, you're taking meat. He says, B'chayiv Makas, he's called it a Min Basar. He's in Mechalik in the Rambam, says it's Isser Machlas Atzmai.
Right.
So why would that not be the same case? I mean, the Chazanish, the Chalkos Yoyev, they seem to agree with this understanding of the in the Rambam from Reb Chaim.
Right.
So
let me just tell, accordingly,
it stands the logic that if you harvest a stem cell hamburger and it's extracted and developed from the meat itself, and the mice have the same physical and chemical properties of the meat, wouldn't these according still hold this yotze is not a stam yotze but a min basar?
So let me just explain to our audience what Rabbi Spitz is saying. The debate here is that a derivative product, which is a yotze, like he says, you know, the milk, the meraglayim, any other product, would be parv because it's a yotze min atzayir. There's certainly Rabbanim on the yotze is parv. There's a Mishnah Melech that way. But what Rabbi Spitz is saying is he's saying that this is not a derivative product. This is merely a continued growth, albeit in an unnatural situation in a laboratory, of an existing product. So it's not a derivative product. It's the same product that has, through scientific method, has continued to grow. And therefore, it's not a good comparison to derivative. Am I stating the debate clearly, Rabbi Spitz?
Mostly.
I
would agree it's considered somewhat of a derivative, but a derivative, not according to the Rambam's basic understanding, but a derivative as Reb Chaim understood it, the Rambam. Meaning that there's a nafka mina, there's a differentiation, and it's between the actual, in the dinim of yotze, if the yotze is a min basar atzma, then for sure the Rambam would be maskim, it's considered a min basar. Because what the lashon they use is, it's not as lenient as a standard yotze, but if they consider it shaykh leguf habriya, or a basar gomer.
Okay, so let me ask you the following question, Rabbi Spitz. You seem to have the conclusion, or you're certainly note, you certainly be taking, you're saying it would be a big suffix, which that it would be fleshik. So we would not get the kosher cheeseburger that way, but would it make sense to do it for another reason? You shecht one animal, you would slaughter it in the most ideal, you would get the most reliable shochet in history. You'll have Aaron HaKohen come to shecht this, right? That meat would certainly be basar kosher. Then once you take that and you grow it, you never need to have a shochet again. In effect, You would never have a problem with Bedikas Harayim. Everything would be glatt. You would never have all the shilos of all the different trefis that you have in beginning of your day, etc. So couldn't we do away with all the
halachic? What are you growing it into?
You're growing it into this huge 50-pound slab of beef in laboratory conditions in some type of that. And I actually had a fund here in the United States from Atlanta come up to my office recently, and they were looking for investors, and they said they actually grow it in vats with various chemicals, growth chemicals, which is why it's so expensive. He said the chemicals, usually they come in tiny milliliter things that are injected into people who have issues, and now they're buying it by the drum load. So they would take a stem cell and grow it into this 500 or 1,000 or basically endless, and you would never have tarfis, you would never have, you know, everything would be glatt, everything would be mahudr, you know, and it would do away with all kashrus issues, well, at least from the shechita, from the bedika, etc., from its inception. What do you think of that? It would be the most glatt meat imaginable. That would basically be the
right now, I would say the summer between sci-fi and fantasy.
But that's for the...
In an extreme theoretical case, could that make sense? Ken Zine, it could, but you have to make a strong case at the point. You're just having a gigantic piece of meat that was originally kosher. I mean,
right.
What more are you doing to it? If you're not growing into a cow, you're not having any issues.
No. So basically, halachically, it would be very mahudadika meat. It would be, you could have it Beis Yosef Shechita, and you'll have a shochet from Satma, Chabad, Beis Yosef, Litvish, whatever, and they'll all do it together. They'll do the bedikas together, and you've created literally the most kosher animal in history. That would be an advantage, wouldn't it?
Clear, I can hear that. When it comes in the realm of practicality, you know, you let me know. But I'll tell you, on a practical level, before all of the other issues even we work out, let's say we work out myrcine, which on a cheeseburger would be a huge issue, right? So, okay, sisters are bottom, we'll say, hey, but the issue is if you use a trace animal for, say they decide to do with a trace animal, you got problems with enevatos or chatkila, how it applies to a guy. There was famous precedent to that was from Rabbi Gesson with Coca-Cola. Let's all the place in there. But let's say we take your case. But right now, the growth medium has been revealed. They use calf blood in it. The main thing they're using, so Pashas is a maimed anyway. This will never be butthole. And but even if I use all the fakis and I want to say it's mutter and pyres and gewaldic, the growth medium they're using is calf blood.
Not in Atlanta.
Trace up blood. So it's okay. Soaking in blood, 24 hours, it's kavush kemevushal, it's trace. You'll never have shishim against blood if it's being soaked in blood.
But that's the laboratory I spoke to isn't using blood at all. It's all artificial compounds. It's all chemical.
Yes?
Yeah.
The reason why I'm saying that, I received an email communication from a food scientist that she said that she went to a, where is it? There's a link. They sent me something about this, they went to a seminar. The famous food scientist has a website, kashrut.com. Mrs. Scharf, she was, you know, tirelessly, as far as I know, I've seen she communicated with me a few times over the years, but to find out, you know, like get to the emes amit of what's going on in food and food scientists. And she said, I think Bizel Ocean, she says she went to a seminar by the guy in himself, Professor Mark Post. They're trying to develop an animal-free nutrient solution, but it said that this technology is a long way to go before it is feasible. That's an exact, you know, as far as I know, it's a recent quote. So if you tell me that they found some way to do that since then, I mean, sounds very interesting. But,
yeah.
I mean, that was like one of the things that they sort of hid originally when all the OU and the others, they all seem to be talking about it when Shiloh first came up and they first made this announcement. Everyone's rushing to try to be Magduri, the kosher cheeseburger, or could it be even Shiloh Bechlal? When that whole issue came up, that was hidden. They didn't even know that.
No, but Rabbi Spitz, I'll tell you why they had to find artificial, because most of the people who are going to buy this, at least initially, are going to be doing it for moral reasons and are vegetarian. That's the goal, one of the people they want to reach. And these people would
be
absolutely would be repulsed if it was being done on cow blood. So it would be basically a stirumine ube, which is why they've had to look for but the bottom line is the people I spoke to. Now, let me ask you another halacha, Shaila. Certainly, Tzar Balachayim, right, when we kill animals is an issue. But Tzar Balachayim was hutra, if it's l'tzayra hachilas adam, there is no, you know, there is no other way, right? But...
Yeah, famous Noidib Yehuda.
Right,
Noidib Yehuda,
l'gabe hunting. Yeah, l'gabe hunting.
L'gabe hunting, that's correct.
Yeah. So here's the question. If they, in effect, we could create the most kosher possible beef by doing it from stem cells of an existing animal that was nishchat, and then post that, we never have to shecht another animal, we never have to terrify another animal, would it be a halachic requirement al tzar b'lechayim to say, just, you don't have to kill the animal. Buy it in the supermarket from something that was pain-free. Would that be a reason to buy it, Pashit? Or why be mitzayer so many? And I've spoken to people who work in schlachtaises, and they say that anybody who thinks that the animals, when they're taken away, are not terrified, he says they've never been in such a situation. And I don't want to go to the gruesome videos online that you could watch, you know what I mean, from kosher schlachtaises. But would that be a halachic and a moral reason to say, why be mitzayer an animal? Buy it in the supermarket this way.
That's a very interesting question, and actually very, you know, our Messiah is our Messiah. And, you know, one of the rayas of, is Moshe Rabbeinu taught Shechita, in the Torah Shabbat Peh, Torah Shabbat Ksav, or one, is one of the rayas of Shechita. I don't believe, even if we find some way out, or a better method, or something that possibly can be potentially tagged as a better method, like you're saying in the Tzias of Schlachtaisen, I don't know. That's not my department. Definitely not my thing, as they say. But, you know, we have our stone Messiah.
We have no Messiah
thousands
against
of years.
Hello.
I don't believe that we can
no
go
Messiah
and we found a better way.
Well,
you
no
have
Messiah
to have
where,
a...
But there's no Messiah where you have an option to do it pain-free. There's no such a Messiah.
You know, I'll tell you what. When such a thing comes to Megaya, we'll revisit the topic, and we'll see how and when such a thing can actually be possible or not. As you said, you spoke to Rabbi Ganak on that. He gives Ashkocha to, right, the largest kosher agency in the world. What's his take on that?
I didn't ask him this question, but I happen to know that I
would think that would be more of a question for him. He's giving Ashkocha to Shlach Kodesh.
I have a door. No, but halachically you're allowed to. There's no suffix. That's not a shaila. The shaila is where you have
no.
an option.
If you ask me, halachically you're allowed to, l'chayra, yes.
No.
Did I say that you're mechuyev to?
No, Rabbi Spitz. Respectfully, there's no suffix that if a person wants to eat meat, he's allowed to eat basa shchuta, and that doesn't apply. We have a new development now. You could eat meat that was through tzar b'lechayim, that's mutl l'tzayra chadam. Or you could eat the same exact quality meat that never had any bavua de bavua of tzar b'lechayim on it because of new methods. There's no messiah on that. Would we be then somebody to say you could torture an animal or not? Of course, la'alacha, why would you have tzar b'lechayim? Go eat the synthetic beef. They say that Arizal wouldn't kill a fly. I saw Reb Chaim Vital writes that Arizal would not kill a mosquito or a fly. So we have a real tradition of not having tzar b'lechayim. So we're matir it because we need it for eichel. Well, we don't need the heter anymore. Do it the other way. So if it's unaffordable, I can understand. But if they were the same region of affordability, right, the same zip code of affordability, would it make sense for Ruff to come out and say, stop eating basa shchuta, go eat the painless beef?
That's it. I'm sure someone could say it. The question is, how well would such a thing be makabel? Again, you'd have to see the mitzvahs when the time is and see what the haskamas of the gedolim are.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. I understand it. I never actually thought about that because, as I said, this seems to be very, very far off, even being a gedolim ha'isa b'chlal.
They say 2023.
The big problem is once people start touting ethics over halacha or mesorah, usually it's a very slippery slope. So if Rabbanim would come out that way,
you know, I wish them hatzlacha, and you know, we'll see what happens when the time comes.
Uh-huh.
But
okay.
I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that all these other things, ethical hashkachas, and who knows where or what they're coming for, and you see that the actual kashrus sort of becomes negated along the way. So it just seems we'll be very wary of such an innovation until such a thing is actually proven to be for the right purposes, for the right reasons. I mean, when the time comes, I'm sure the Gedolim will speak out about it.
Well, Rabbi Spitz, thank you for bringing such a fascinating and current issue to our attention, and we wish you much hatzlacha.
Amen. Shein lomar.
Thank you. Kol tov. Bye-bye. Enjoyed this program. Remember, go out and buy Headlines 2. It's the most fascinating English halacha sefer you will buy this year. It will make you one of the more interesting people at the table. Have a wonderful week.